This episode of The Slow Good Life is brought to you by Slow Talk Podcasting, a turnkey recording studio featuring podcast development, production, distribution, and marketing. Check out Slow Talk Podcasting online at slowtalkpodcasting.com or call them at 805-234-5056.
Kenny Lee Lewis of the Steve Miller Band, part two of the Slow Good Life podcast. If anyone follows you on social media, they know that you're quite the gardener.
That's only been the last year. It's about the last year I really started.
You grow a variety of different things.
A variety.
Variety packs.
It's just in the last year. Now that I've got the land, you know, thanks to beating Bank of America, and you know, I've got areas to grow things, you know, because I'm going to stay here at this place for a while, you know. So I figured, hey, let's put a raised bed garden and see if it works. Because I've seen other neighbors do it at work.
Yeah.
Well, why can't I do it?
Yeah. You know? Why can't I do it too?
Yeah.
Artichokes.
Yeah. I got artichoke growing right now. I had my first baby artichoke, you know. It's pretty exciting.
What would you say you've had the most success growing?
Zucchini were huge.
Of course.
But they were really mean.
Tomatoes and zucchini.
I couldn't get the spines on my skin because it would be like poison oak on my body. Ooh. So I had to get rid of the zucchini. But I had some giant zucchinis that were like from hell, you know. But the tomatoes were incredible. We got, you know, mint. We got strawberries. You know, we just get a few, you know. This is kind of fun. Yeah. This year, I'm doing eggplant, both Chinese and Japanese. Quite a few peppers and a whole lot of tomatoes.
Yeah, nice.
And we got onion and cilantro and, cool. you know, just, you know, collard greens and mustard greens, you know, because we like to, Diane's from Memphis. We make collard greens.
Yeah.
We make greens.
Yeah.
And they're nice when they're fresh.
And a barbecue to go with the collard greens.
We got a barbecue. Yeah. We do. Yeah. We got a hell of a tri-tip recipe, too.
And a pergoda.
A pergola.
Pergola. There you go.
Yeah.
A pergoda. What the heck is a pergoda?
That would be the Japanese.
It sounds like a Japanese sports car. I drive a pergoda, for God's sakes. No.
Right. That's pretty funny. But yeah, I put up a pergola with a hammock, and that came from us going down to Yucatan the last couple of years to do some shows down there for another seminar music school thing down there. And all of our little rooms had a back patio with a hammock and nice chairs and a little chill hang, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, these hammocks are cool. Then I found out even the people that had money down there were sleeping in hammocks.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They just were so used to sleeping in them all their lives when they get a nice house and stuff, they still got a hammock hanging up.
Why not keep it going?
Because they're very comfortable. I mean, they are really amazing.
I have actually slept at Live Oak Music Festival in a hammock. They're wonderful. Yeah. I don't know why I don't
tie one
up at
home. You just have to set them up right, and you know, and get it the right dangle and angle and everything. But you're actually like in the mother's womb with this thing.
They support the body, surround it really good, man.
Yeah.
I forgot to bring my memory phone. I did remember to bring the hammock.
So I'm doing that. I got a fire ring, you know, and I got like little walkways and stuff. So
it's oasis out there.
Yeah, and then we put in some trees lately for privacy. So, you know, it's coming together.
Cool.
Kenny, you also like to fish. In fact, we were a couple of years ago, we were doing some messaging, and you had just either gone to a show or got back from a show. We may have to stop in Instagram Live and get some refreshments here in a minute, but you were coming back from a show and you were messaging, and you had just done some fishing on the road, a little walk from a hotel. It was kind of crazy, man. And tell us about your fishing fun that you do.
Well, you know, my father and my brother, who's older, were very instrumental in showing me when I was very young fishing. And it was something that we could relate to because my brother was 7 years older. It was kind of hard for him to like get down his hands and knees with me on everything that I did.
Yeah.
Although he was very good about some of that. I mean, he was a great older brother.
Yeah.
But the age difference made it so there wasn't a lot of things we could do together. Fishing was something my dad and my brother and I could do together because you're just sitting in one place. it's luck. It's like, you know, you never know what's going to happen. So you're all just sort of sitting around all equal. Age doesn't have anything to do with it. And usually the little kid's the one that catches a big fish.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what was going on. I was doing pretty good with that. And it made me feel also have confidence, because when I would catch a fish and my brother and my dad couldn't do it, I'd go, wow, man. I'm not as much of a loser as I think I am, you know.
And a lot of places around Sacramento to fish too.
Oh yeah, man. Yeah. We were like we had the ocean in one direction, Tahoe in the other direction, Shasta in the other direction, and then the river was right there.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a million fish in the river. Oh. So we just had a really great kind of a sub-rural kind of an upbringing out there, you know.
And you've kept this going, the fishing.
Kept it going, and then I was a Boy Scout and in YMCA
I did
ragger.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I was a YMCA ragger first, and then I was a Boy Scout. I didn't do Cub Scouts. I went right from ragger to Boy Scout.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, almost became an Eagle Scout. I was a Life Scout.
Yeah.
And what happened was that the Vietnam War was raging. And me and my patrol leader partner friend of mine, Dave Long, who's still a good friend of mine,
yeah.
We just kind of looked at each other one day, you know, while we were down by the river and going like, you know, I think they were trying us to go kill Asian people in the jungle. I think maybe we should get out of this Boy Scout thing because they're training us to become killers.
It's not cool.
And we quit the Boy Scouts. And that's when I started playing music full time.
Okay.
Yeah, because
okay.
I was kind of a gung-ho, you know, moderate liberal, conservative, mid down the line. Because in those days, you know, if you were really hard left, I mean, you were Jane Fonda. I mean, that was it. You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I was kind of gung ho. I was going to go in the Navy. I was going to do officers training school. I was going to become an electronics engineer. You know, I had it all planned out. You know, I was going to do Submarine Corps. You get more money.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's kind of
nuclear
fun.
Certified.
The best food, the best movies.
I've heard this.
Yeah. My brother-in-law did it. He was in the Submarine Corps. So that's why I was going to be brought in. And then they demolished the draft just before my number came up.
Shooting your brother-in-law probably was going to get a bonus for bringing in or something, man.
So now you still got to do some great fishing excursions while you're out on tour, don't
you? Right. So, fishing. So now I'm, you know, outdoor-y, I'm backpacking, I'm the Boy Scout up in the mountains, and you know, all this stuff. Then I kind of get away from it for a while to do the music thing, and I move down to L.A. and I become a studio musician. And then when I started getting a little established, my friend Kurt, who grew up in Fresno, who still lives in Simi, he's a good friend of mine, we're talking about going again at the end of this month. We did it last year. We always go up to the Sierras, our beloved Sierras. Nice. We know right where these great spots were, where the native fish are. And, you know, and it's like, it's sort of like a thing, you know. Yeah, I can catch bigger fish and more fish maybe up in Montana, but this is our neighborhood, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's nice, and we know some areas that are very private. Which
there's
cool.
something
that
incredible about going
so,
out fishing and enjoying
when
that.
I'm out on the road, I'm bored a lot. The guys don't do a lot. The other guys in the band, a lot of them don't hang the way I do. They kind of stay in their rooms and just do other stuff. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The guitar player will go out to dinner with me, and that's about it. But everybody else kind of keeps themselves
mm-hmm.
and their wives or whatever. So I go fishing because, you know, I'm out in all these different areas of the United States every year, some places I've never been to before, with water features. That's and cool. I just go like, I wonder what's out there.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Do you bring some equipment with you, Ken?
Yeah. I bring a little pack rod, you know, nice. I got all my stuff, you know.
Nice.
It's kind of kooky. It's just a silly thing to do.
It's cool to hear though, man. Yeah. It's cool to hear.
Yeah.
And then in the back of the bus when we're traveling is when I do the riding.
Yeah.
So, and the fishing's on day offs and also after sound check, if there's a water feature near the gig, after sound check, I'll go fish right up to downbeat. I mean, I'll hear the opening act playing while I'm bringing fish in.
Nice.
You know.
Nice.
A mile away, you know.
Kenny, speaking of writing, we were talking about skeleton dolls. I started Googling that from the car on my phone. It came up trying to sell me dolls from Etsy.
Right.
I guess I wasn't specific enough.
Yes.
But then I saw that you've already produced one book, one novel.
Yes. And it's been out for a couple of years now.
Yeah, and you're working on a second one right now.
Correct. Yeah. The Skeleton Dolls, Children of the Tower was a self-produced book that's still available on Amazon, both on Kindle and hard copy,
mm-hmm.
and it gets great reviews and stuff.
It's
like
a sci-fi,
sci-fi fantasy about female identical twins mm-hmm. who speak in twin speak, and they carry that characteristic into their adult life, which usually doesn't happen. But if you Google twin speak, you'll see that a lot of twins will speak in their own language when they're little, and nobody knows what it is, you know. But they know what it is.
Interesting.
But the parents don't know. It just sounds like a bunch of fast gibberish.
Yeah.
But they have a language they speak in. It's their own language, and nobody knows what it is. You know, they've never been in a dictionary, a thesaurus put together for it. So I kind of take that and move that into kind of like a fantasy thing.
That's cool.
And then I met a pair of, well, of course it would be a pair. I met a female identical twins, one of which was going with our bass player at that time. I met their mother, and she told me some really scary stories about what they were like when they were little, with their telepathy and their strange stuff that they would do. So a couple of the stories the mom told me, I said, can I run with those stories if I change the names? And she went, yeah, go ahead. So I took those stories of their real life, true story, and I took them up to about the 12th chapter on that in the book. And then from there, I take it Stephen King, Dan Brown. It goes way out.
And so
any tribbles in there? I know you're a Trekkie.
No, just kidding.
There's a little bit of alien stuff in all my books. Yeah.
The trouble with tribbles.
Yeah, yeah.
Craig brought three into the studio tonight just for you to see. No.
Yes.
Do you?
There we go.
I brought my wife home one from the MGM, whatever the Las Vegas hotel that has the Star Trek thing. They have a ride up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually had little trebles that vibrate. I brought one home. It's her favorite thing, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so some of your stories come from just rubbing elbows with people in their stories.
Yes.
And weaving that into novel.
I find, as a novelist, that truth is stranger than fiction. Mm. Just like with the song I just wrote that you were talking about, Dead Man's Hand, that I just did the other day.
Yeah.
That was really easy to write because it was true. And it was a very, very bizarre story. And it was like, it was so easy to write the song because it happened.
You lived,
you know, so I just documented it like a journalist, you know.
Yeah. Why don't you share that story briefly? Because I don't think we had that while we were recording. I want to hear about that song. You're going to open up your gig tomorrow night with this song.
Yeah. Well, I had an accident about 5 years ago where I was doing a jazz gig in Florida. It was end of the night. People had already left. They were feeding us. It was great food. I'd had a great jazz gig. I changed my clothes and put my sandals back on and my shorts because it was Florida. And while we were eating, this kid came out and he mopped the tile in back of us and didn't tell anybody. Didn't put any orange cones up. Didn't tap me on the shoulder. Said, "Watch back here." I hadn't even had a drink for about an hour and a half, but I had this big tumbler that was full of lemons and limes, just the way I wanted it for a nice margarita. And they were just getting ready to close the bar. So I was going to get up and get one more drink. And there were still a couple people still in the place, even though they kind of closed. And they'd start mopping. Like I said, I didn't know they were mopping. So I grabbed this tumbler. It was about this big. And I made a left-hand turn around a table, and my sandals went out from under me on that soapy water so fast that I had to throw my hands down immediately to keep my head from hitting the back, you know, on the tile.
Yeah.
And crack my skull, you know. So I just threw my hands down as fast as possible to break my fall. And that doggone tumbler was right under my hand. It just broke, and it cut me all the way from here to here, if you can see this big, long scar. And if you take this and you just put it right along there, you'll see that it was just like the edge of the tumbler.
Oh,
that's how it did the cut.
Wow.
Right along there. And it cut arteries and nerves.
Whoa.
And we're on the road. And I'm playing bass with the Steve Miller Band.
Ugh.
So we had a couple days off, thank God. And I didn't know what to do, you know. And we had to keep it a secret from Steve because, you know, he's very, very, he's very protective about this kind of stuff. And he's very much into, like, health and surgery. And his dad was a pathologist, so he knows something about medicine. Mm-hmm. So he probably would have had me in surgery right away, would have hired another bass player. Mm-hmm. And they would have either canceled the tour or done partial of the tour. And it would have just been crazy. So we decided to just not tell them, you know. And so the crew and managers just said, let's just see if you can make your sound check in 2 days. And sure enough, I did. And but the problem was I'd cut nerves. And I had to continue to finish the tour. And then I had 2 weeks off to go to Cedars to get consultation about it. He says, you should be in surgery like a week ago. And I said, I can't. We got a tour coming in 2 weeks up in Canada or something. And he was like, oh my God, you need to do this now. I said, I can't. So I had to let it heal over with no feeling. I was pretty much playing the bass with two fingers.
Oh, wow.
But nobody could tell. I just pulled it off. So anyway, eventually we finally got done with all the touring, went back, he opened me up. And the reason why I had to get nerve replacement is because there was neuromas at the end of each nerve now, and they had separated and stretched away. And so the doctor says, well, you're going to have nerve replacement. He goes, do you want synthetic or cadaver? That's where the story comes in. And I went like, well, I'm kind of a nature boy. I think I'll go with the cadaver.
The natural.
You know? And so what they do is they take a real nerve encasement from a human. And they denature it. They take all the living cells out of it, get the DNA out of it so there's no rejection. Mm. And then they attach it to the little ends of your little broken nerve that, and put that little bridge piece in the middle and splice it with two little sutures and some super glue.
Super glue.
And I have pictures of this. I was out, of course. Yeah. But this guy has pictures that he gave me. And I was like, oh, my God. My hands all open. It looked like that thing in, like, you know, the alien, you know, when they're studying under the microscope.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy.
So he reconstructed my nerves with cadaver nerves on both my ring and my little finger. My ring finger came back. The cells grew across the bridge of the denatured material, the sheath or shaft or whatever. But the little one, I only got sensation on the top of my finger, but on the bottom of the finger and on my tip, it's still numb. And like right when I do this, I can feel like little electric shocks and stuff, but it's really connecting. But the joke is that people say, well, what happened to you? And I said, well, I got the nerves of a dead man's hand now in my hand, you know. And so the more and more I said this, told the story, I said, I don't write a blues song about the nerves of a dead man's hand. So the other day I got a bug. I got the studio. I got all the gear. You know, so I just went out there and said, I'm going to do it today. And I went out there and wrote the lyrics, recorded the little demo in like 6 hours.
Ah, cool.
Had it done, mixed, you know, and that's what's that I put up on
so what we're hearing is the demo for the song.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, the vocals are a little rough and, you know.
Oh, it's a decent track,
I did
track,
the lead
though.
Guitar in one take.
It's
you know?
A decent track.
Yeah,
though.
I just threw it together with a drum machine, you know. It's like, it's just, you know, but it rocks, you know.
Are you going to roll that out at the show coming up, Ken?
Yes, I'm going to open up the show tomorrow night with it. You know?
We're looking forward to
so
that.
So that's the nerves of a dead, so it's just called Dead Man's Hand.
Yeah.
But I made up a little story about how the nerves came from a blues guy down in, you know, the Delta. And he'd long passed, but he was like a really great player, you know, kind of like a crossroads, soul to soul to the devil.
So you have
Robert
a phantom,
Johnson
right.
kind of a story.
You have a phantom blues
So now
hand
I have up. His nerves in my hand and I play differently because I have his nerves. So that's the novelist in me coming out.
That's cool. Know?
So he wove it into a song.
Yes.
Yeah, the long form is a book. Kenny, the future, the looking ahead, a lot of stuff happening. Maybe we don't stop and do that, but Slow Good Life, a lot of times we talk about vision, some things you want to see done, maybe in the community. Yeah, we live in a beautiful area, and yet there's some things that maybe you want to see change or be better or be protected.
Well, I mean, if you let's just talk about some specific, you know, type of things related to the music business.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't really see a whole lot of support around here for live music from, you know, business people. There's a few nightclubs that have stages and lights and sound, and like Tomorrow Night at the Siren, that's one of them. Thank goodness that club came about.
Thank
the way
goodness.
It is.
Yeah, it's really been good.
Slow Rock is now coming around.
Yes. Yeah.
They're not really supporting the local people very much, but they're bringing a lot of acts and they're getting college kids in there, and it's a great sound system and a nice stage.
Yeah.
You know, I've never played the new Slow Brew downtown. I know that's kind of a temporary stage, and it's really loud in there, and it's just not. They didn't design it for sound. They designed it for just a restaurant hang and a microbrewery. Mm-hmm. But there's not very many places to play. D'Ambino's the one that we do up there in Santa, up in Paso.
That's nice
one of another one.
Wonderful.
So there's just a couple little rooms you could play, but there's not a lot. Most of the bands around here have to play in like a concrete slab in the back of the winery or up against a window in the corner,
You know, Todd and Corey Newman of Good Medicine Presents, I believe they're on track with some partners to take the Fox Theater in Paso Robles on Spring Street. Turn it into a full-blown brewery and a music center.
Well, we hope that comes to fruition. That's been in talk for quite some time now. Yeah,
that'd be great. And the only reason why this is happening, I'll remind you, is that the musicians themselves, God bless them, are not too worried about making a stink about that. And then also they'll work for peanuts or nothing because they want to go up on stage and perform.
Yeah.
Now, there's nothing wrong with that. I don't want to take that away from someone, you know.
Still.
But being a professional and being somebody who was in the union and a double scale, you know, session cat with like retirement and the whole bit, it's a different ball game when you look at it as a business. But there's a lot of weekend warrior entertainers that don't look at it as a business. They just want to get on stage no matter what.
Yeah.
And they will do it for peanuts.
Yeah.
And the businesses know that.
Yeah.
And they know that when their audience gets drunk enough, they can't tell the difference between a really good band and just an okay band.
Yeah, that's an issue.
So they hire a lot of okay bands that still are entertaining, I guess, and people have fun. Mm-hmm. But it brings down the price of everything. And so, and then they don't develop and they don't spend any money for staging and lights and green rooms and a sound guy, you know, and like put a Jumbotron and back for multimedia, you know, like all that stuff that we get like at, well, Slow Rock. And then the place I'm playing on Sunday the 19th down West in Lake L.A., Westlake Village. I'm playing this place called Bogies. Uh-huh. And they have all that. And that's a really nice gig to do.
And to our listeners, support these places. Folks, go out and support live music. It's proven that if you see a live show every 2 weeks, you'll live longer, statistically proven.
Yeah. And you're not going to make a big living playing these places. I mean, it's just okay money, but there are professional players in this town that do these gigs for a living, you know, and I got to pay them. I want to make sure they make a pretty good wage, at least the same amount they used to make in 1975. You know what I mean? Because it's like, it's hard to make that kind of money, you know?
It is.
So, you know, it's hard for them to make a living at this. So, you know, we talked about this at Tooth and Nail at one of the music conferences a couple of years ago. Me and Terry were talking about it. Uh-huh. And, you know, just trying to get businesses, especially the wineries, who seem to be doing pretty good.
I think so.
To put a little money in and just build a really good indoor. And one of the only people that I've seen do it recently, Rava Winery.
Rava.
Kudos to them for what they've done making that investment.
And next weekend on the 18th, they're having the same band that we did at New Year's, which is this...
Sunset Winos.
Yes. And they, it's just a band that Stefan Adika and a couple of guys put together. And I sat in with it, which was fun. I think I'll go see them again. You know, if they have me sit in, fine. I don't care.
Nice.
But I'm not on the bill, but I'm going to go see it.
Hang on.
But the indoor venue that we did at New Year's was amazing. Great sound, great light stage. They roll it out. They drop the PA down. It's pro. You can have, like, you know, national acts there. They've just had Rick Springfield.
Like
Bellamy Brothers is coming.
Coming.
They got Andrew Dice Clay is coming.
Oh, really? I didn't know Dice was coming.
Yeah. They've got a whole bunch of stuff going on there.
Player.
So there's a place Chad Robin and his wife put together, you know, with their dad, with his dad and stuff.
Yeah.
They got serious, and they spent the money and did it right.
That's neat.
It's people just are not doing that very often.
No.
So that's a challenge to you business people out there that have restaurants and wineries and microbreweries. Just, you know, step it up a little bit. You
support
know?
Local music and musicians.
Yeah,
I think this area is going to continue to swell with music, and I think opportunity is going to expand. Of course, it's all about money. It's all about pleasing the tourists, pleasing the locals. But I think the opportunities for good musicians are going to grow. I'm bullish on that.
Well, it also helps the community because, like I said, it brings people from all both sides of the political spectrum together.
Yeah.
You know, we can get the cowboys in there from Atascadero mixed in with the left coasties from SLO and get them in the same room. Get them to embrace each other. You know, maybe they'll go to the dispensary the next day and hang out together. You know,
so we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So, you know, music, I think, makes the community better.
Yeah.
And it makes the children better. The children's math skills improve with music. You know, we're talking about in the school districts, too.
Yeah.
And here, thank goodness, they still have music in the
And it just straight up feeds the soul.
It does. Rock and roll is good for the soul.
Yeah. Music so, you know. There you go. So to answer your question, I mean, that's my first challenge to the county is to, you know, to step up, you know, supporting the arts a little more.
Kenny, thank you for that. We support that, too, you know, here at Slow Talk. And we identify with that and feel that, man. That's so important. Art is an enrichment of life of all ages, especially our young people. Don't let it go. Mm-hmm. I remember when Bill Graham did that in San Francisco, did Snack Sunday, because he said, I'll be darned if or damned if the students are going to suffer. And he created that concert, man, and everybody showed up to support
Now, the jazz thing they do down by the Mission every year, it's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. Hey, before
we
wrap up,
are you involved with
that? I used to be. It didn't happen last year. There's some reasons for that, but I really appreciate the 5 years that I invested in that, and I'd love to see music at the Mission.
I mean, it's a temporary stage, but at least everybody gets to have a large area where they can all go and see a really great national act.
Absolutely, and we want to see more of that happen.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, I mean, Avila is doing pretty good with their shows. That's good. We work for Otter. I mean, is it Otter?
Otter Productions.
Yes.
Yeah.
We work for him, and it's like, you know, at least they're keeping that going.
Oh, absolutely. Good, it's a beautiful venue.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about your the Ben Franklin founding father, the five-string bass.
Wow.
I want to ask you about that because that's an interesting story. Why don't you share about how that all came together?
Okay. I have a guitar player, a friend of mine, who's kind of a nutty kid. that owns a jewelry store in Rhode Island. And he's a great guitar player, worked with me with a guitar amplifier corporation years ago called Rivera. And he's just remained friends over the years. And he's very giving. He's like always sends me gifts from time to time, you know, because I have his wife and him come to the shows like we play out there on the mm-hmm. East Coast. And he friended me, or gifted me, I should say, with a Telecaster guitar that the body was from a shipwreck called the Coronet that kind of sank off the New England coast, like, you know, I don't know, 300 years ago, something like that. Mm-hmm. And they reclaimed some of the planks from this boat, which were pine, of all things, but because they'd been compressed under the sea for long, they became very rigid, very hard and compressed, and they ended up using them for flooring at an American Tourister factory in New England. And that they were on the floor for about 100 years doing that. So anyway, this guy is into reclaiming wood. So he got with a wood reclamation company, and he ended up buying some boards, which were these boards that were in the shipwreck that were the floor of the American Tourister, you know, factory. They got torn down, and they reclaimed the wood. So he made guitar bodies from them, and they made a Telecaster with this wood, and, you know, bought some parts and put it together, and he just sent it to me as a gift. It was, like, so cool. The thing weighs a ton. Oh, it's pine, but because it's so compressed, it's almost like ebony. It weighs so much. It's crazy. So I wouldn't be playing it live very much, but it hangs in my studio, and it looks great. Cool. And I've had some pictures of it online. And so the same guy that made that, made the body, I became friends with him. His name is Vincent Goulart. And Vinny asked me one day, he goes, "Hey, I got some of this wood from Ben Franklin's birth house." And I went, "Where's that?" He goes, "Well, it was One Milk Street in Boston." It was like, he was like born there. It was like 1709 when he was born there or something, you know. And they said that they had these beams in there that had to be replaced by metal beams because they were improving the building. It was old. And so they were taking out some of these wooden beams, which were spruce, of all things. And he got a hold of those. And so he asked me what I wanted. And just as a gift, I said, "Well, I'm thinking about maybe having a Kenny Lee Lewis signature bass. And since nobody's offered to build one for me, you know, I'll just do it myself because I'm a luthier. I was trained as a kid as a luthier." And so he made me a rough cut body. It was a jazz bass shaped body, but with P bass pickup wells in it. And I asked him to make the heel of the neck wide enough for 5-string. So it was going to be a 5-string P bass, but with a jazz bass body. So he sends this body. It's, you know, just unfinished body. And I go, "God, I'm going to have to build this doggone guitar." So I went online, and I bought all the parts I needed, and I made this bass. And it's just the coolest bass. And it's my signature thing. I've got a silver 1954, the year I was born, 50-cent piece inset in the front of it.
I saw that, an inset.
And then I've got, you know, some decals that I put on and stuff, you know, and I finished it with, what is it, the tongue oil, you know. And it turned out really good. So it's natural. It's all natural looking. But I used it on the recordings for Cody Blackbird's newest album.
Really?
And also some tracks on the first album, too.
That's cool, man.
And it's the bass that's on Dead Man's Hand.
Wow.
So that's the Franklin it's the Franklin Founding Father Fender 5.
That is hecka cool, man. The Kenny Lee Lewis signature model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a P bass with 5-string.
That's cool. Yeah, that's really cool, that's man. Cool. So you are truly a jack of all trades. You do a lot of creative stuff, Kenny.
Yeah. Well, I've done a lot of stuff in the music business, you know, both manufacturing, sales training, you know, electronics, you know, amp design, sales, you know, Guitar Center, training. That's how I got into Guitar Center, was training the Rivera line and meeting all those people. I started Schecter Guitar with Dave Schecter in 1974.
Wow, really?
Wow.
And that was a parts thing first. Wow. And then eventually we made full guitars, and then it bought and sold a couple of times. And now it's a Korean company, Taiwanese, Korean, something like that. But yeah, we were making them in Van Nuys, right on Sherman Way. And Sepulveda and Sherman Way.
Where that's at, man.
Yeah.
Guitar sales are way down, been down a couple of years. What's they're easier to buy in the used market because of social media. There's not as much interest. What's going on?
I don't know. I think that the millennial kids are not so interested in trying to become a rock star. Mm. Hell, they don't even want a car.
It's actually
they don't want to buy a house. Different mentality, they don't want a car. Man. You know, they just want to eat pho and get stoned and drive around on skateboards in their 20s. You know,
different times.
Yeah. And that's fine. I mean, you know, I'm not going to besmirch that. But I mean, it's like the thing of it is that they. I don't think they're the boomers. We all grew up with that classic rock and roll era thing, and so it's an obsession. You know, it's like a thing. You know, it's like
a major part of it.
A major part of like the Beatles. God, are you kidding me?
Changed everything.
The millennials, they don't have the Beatles. They don't have
any
Led Zeppelin. They don't have Jimi Hendrix. They just have some guys, you know, what do they have? I don't even know what they have.
I don't know what they have. I didn't check.
Well, we like Rival Sons, but a lot of people know about them.
Yeah, they're pretty good out of Long Beach.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, you know, if they got something, they got something. Yeah. I don't know if they want to make a living doing what Rival Sons do.
Yeah, true.
They might want to, they might make a living, you know, like becoming a computer apps designer or, installations on electronic advancements, so solar energy, electric cars. I don't know. You know, they got different stuff in their head. You know, they're not trying to be a rock star.
Yeah.
So they don't really care about having the Les Paul and the Marshall Stack and all that stuff. You know.
You said the magic name. I've got, before we close, this is going all over the page, but it's okay because our fans are all over the page. Me.
Well,
we've got to talk about Les Paul.
Les Paul.
Les Paul. You got to meet Les Paul, the 90th birthday celebration.
I did. I played Carnegie Hall for his 90th birthday. And I got to go to his house up in Jersey and go into his basement and see the original log and all the original, you know, little micro, you know, harmonica clips that he invented for around the neck and, you know, all those, you know, goofy things he never got credit for, lapping, you know, a multi-track heads for multi-track recording, Echoplex tape echoes. Certain types of, he had a thing called Les Paul Pulverizer, which was an interesting kind of a device. I can't even explain what it did, but, you know, he was really an innovator and quite an amazing guy, you know, in terms of being a musician and an innovator. Now, his personal life, another story, but all of his music and what he accomplished with gear and his recordings is just amazing.
I don't know much about the personal life. I know the name Les Paul. I know about his development guitar and some of the equipment. And then I saw this video of him and Mary Ford. And I went, oh my gosh, they were so...
They were huge.
The sounds and the stuff they did.
This was before rock and roll.
Yeah.
When Diane's relatives were down on Beale Street inventing rock and roll, Les Paul and Mary Ford were out there doing pop, jazz, Tin Pan Alley-esque type stuff.
Yeah.
That was, you know, the what you were listening to in those. It was like, I don't know, you know, Vic Damone and Frank Sinatra and Les Paul and Mary Ford. I mean, that's what was going on.
Because
big band swing music was kind of going away.
That's what you're saying,
So this was a new area that they got into. And, you know, I don't know if you know this, but he used to take a multi-track tape recorder with him on the road. And him and Mary would sit out front and play their Les Paul guitars and put a whole show on while the multi-track was behind the drapes playing all the other parts. So they were like the first stem track band.
They
had all stem tracks.
That is so cool.
The people in the audience didn't know what was going on. They thought all that music was coming out of the two guitars.
They'd already set it up.
You know, but all the other stuff, the bass and the drums and the background vocals, they were all on a multi-track recording band. And he had a little button. He'd hit it, click, go to the next song, turn it off, you know, talk a little bit, go to the next song, click. So that was in the late 40s.
Way ahead of his time.
So, yeah, it was pretty awesome. And then, of course, he was slowing the tape down, playing those real fast leads, and then speeding up on top of that. So it sounded like he was playing a million miles an hour
up
on two octaves and stuff, you know.
Wow.
So Steve, my boss, was, you know, his godson. And he basically learned not only about all the electronic and the cool stuff to do in the studio, but he also learned about the music business through Les and everything about Capitol Records, because that was the label he got signed to where Les had been for years.
Wow, that's a crazy good story. Yeah.
So that's how we got with Les.
I want to hear one more story, since you're not related to Jerry Lee Lewis.
I met him.
You did meet him.
I met him.
Billy Burnett introduced you guys, right?
At the Palomino.
Yeah, share that.
Do you remember the Palomino?
I've heard about it. I didn't visit it, but I've heard incredible stories.
It was quite a place. I mean, it was in L.A., of course, in North Hollywood. It was just, it looked like your typical roadhouse country bar you'd see in, you know, middle America or whatever. But it was in L.A., and it was country music, which was really cool. But they also would let, you know, crossover rock and roll stuff in there. And Jerry Lee Lewis was, of course, used to play there. And everybody played there. I mean, it was like, you know, Willie Nelson, you know, Johnny Cash. I mean, everybody would come in. And that was like the West Coast country place to play, yeah. You know. So one day we go and we play with Billy Burnett. And this is when Billy and I, we'd done a record with Richie Podler up at American Recording in Woodland Hills. And Curly Smith was a drummer who's now with Boston, drummer. Mm-hmm. And we had a guitar player named Shane Fontaine. You can look him up.
What a name that is.
And he's still around and he's pretty cool. Oh, I mean, yeah. He played really well. Yeah. I think he was part Aborigine, if I'm not mistaken. Very interesting looking mm-hmm. fellow. But he played great. And we had a really good band and a guy named, John Herring on keyboards. He was really good. There's people out in the music business there might be hearing me, on these names. They might ring a bell, but anyway, we had a pretty good band and he was going for a record deal and, we were playing the Palomino, went in, Jerry came in to see him. Cause of course, Billy's dad and uncle go way back to Memphis around the same time that Diane's parents were doing, you know, the jazz stuff down on Beale Street, mm-hmm. the Rockabilly brothers that came in from the Sticks mm-hmm. were his dad and his uncle, wow. which was Dorsey and Johnny Burnett. And they wrote Tear It Up. And wow. again, they were watching Tough Green with that slap of bass thing. And so they started doing that
wow.
and they invented Rockabilly.
Wow.
So that was that bunch, but they were all in Memphis and it was all happening at the same time. It's crazy. Wow. So that was Billy's folks. And so we're in there and Jerry, who grew up with that older bunch, knew Billy from when he was a little kid, came to the show. He was there with some, you know, 13-year-old girl or something. I don't know. I mean, she was some young thing. I don't know if she was 13, but she looked pretty young. But it wasn't his cousin. It was somebody
yeah.
else.
Yeah. It moved on.
And so I got introduced. And yeah. so yeah. he goes, oh, hey, he goes, man, I want you to meet my bass player. Man, his name's Kenny Lee Lewis. He goes, Kenny Lee Lewis? He goes, you stole my name. And I said, I didn't steal your name. My parents named me.
Yeah.
My real name is Kendall Lee Lewis. I said, they would have never named me after you because they hated your music. I said, they were into swing, big swing time jazz music. They hated your music. And he kind of looked back and doubled back and he kind of smiled and he went, Anyway, it's like, that was enough to like convince him that I hadn't stolen his name.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he went, okay.
Okay.
All right. I bless you. And he did like the sign of the cross.
Oh.
You can have my name.
Oh, that's funny. That's awesome. From Jerry Lee to Kenny Lee.
From Kenny
Lee. Right there. To Kenny it's Lee. A Forrest Gump yeah. moment.
Oh, that's an amazing story.
Wow, the Palomino. That. Chris Christensen, local guy, knows Benford really well. His mom and dad, I forget the names, but they started the ACM, Academy of Country Music, and I think they ran the Palomino.
Oh, okay.
And he was telling stories.
Maybe. I don't remember the names of the people that ran the place,
but
that might be true.
Yeah, and in fact, his mom was just honored, I think, posthumously with some sort of award by ACM. Yeah, some history there.
It was a funky joint, man, with just like wood paneling, you know, and like, you know, all the walls were like, you know, paper thin, and there was, you know, debauchery going on in every room. It was nuts backstage.
And then towards the end, Bob Dylan and George Harrison showed up. You know all about that night, right?
I've heard of it. I don't know the details.
Yeah, I saw some pictures. Pretty crazy, man.
Yeah.
Like a friend of mine just happened to be there that night.
Yeah, I played there probably five or six times with different bands of different incarnations.
But... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But well, yeah, but Palomino was cool. So Jerry Lee Lewis met him.
Yeah, Jerry Lee.
Wanda, he's still alive.
Still alive, 79, 81, 87.
Oh, man, I think he's older than that, man.
87?
Yeah.
He's got to be 87 something. Yeah. And I just heard an interview like a year ago with him. He's still around. Chuck Berry's gone.
Talking shit. Yeah.
Chuck is gone, but he's still around.
3 years ago, yeah.
Yeah. I just saw the Million Dollar Quartet in San Luis Obispo, the story of the four, the Sun Records at the Slow Rep Theater.
Yeah.
Excellent. Really well done program, man. Yeah. They may have taken license, but it was well done.
And I'm very, very happy they did that, but they don't know anything about what came before that.
See?
These guys were all big fans of the Newborn and the Steinberg family.
See?
That's who those guys were going to go see.
There's another story here.
Yeah.
All the years with Steve Miller Band, you've played all over the world. What's some of your favorite stops? Is there any gigs that stand out? I mean, there's so many, of course, but is there... someplace you can't wait to get back to again, or just something that stands out. That's just, you know, well, big there, highlight.
There's the bucket list ones. You know, there's Carnegie Hall. Mm-hmm. You know, there's Radio City Music Hall. There's you know, there's the Royal Albert Hall in London. Mm-hmm. The Olympia in Paris. I mean, these are all places that you eventually get to if you're in this business long enough. Yeah. But they're not necessarily the best gigs. They're just bucket list kind of gigs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gigs that I really enjoy are like Red Rocks, like up in like up in a Boulder area, whatever it is. Morrison is the town, is where it is. I love Red Rocks. I love the Gorge in George Washington. It's really cool.
Yeah.
I love. I like that Ironstone Winery because they got great bass fishing there. Up in Murphy's,
up by
Angel's Camp.
Nice perk. Yeah.
I like that little winery, that Palmasan winery that's called the Mountain Winery.
Yeah.
It's up in Saratoga above San Jose.
Yeah.
It's up on the top there, and it was built in 1854.
Wow.
It was the Palmasan Winery, and they've turned that into a really nice gig. And on a really nice day, when you're up in the nosebleed seats and you look up, you can almost see the city.
That's cool.
From way down there.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Now, funky places. This is like Diners, Dives, and Dives-Ins with the guy with the Camaro. Did you ever play Winterland?
No, that was kind of before my time.
That was my haunt. That's the place I went to in high school.
That was before my time. And the Fillmore, too, was before my time. Yeah. I played the Fillmore, but only after it reopened.
Yeah, of course, Concord Pavilion now is the thing. And then Shoreline and all those places. And
Shoreline's a cool gig. It's not... It's a cool gig.
Yeah.
It's got a vibe, you know, because it's got the dead.
The history.
Bill Graham back on stage, and you kind of feel their spirit a little bit there.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice.
Yeah.
But it's not the greatest location. There's no fishing around there because it's all salt flats, you know, so. But yeah, there's some other, I'm trying to think of some others that we've done that are just fantastic, but I can't think of them right now.
Austin, Texas. Kenny, you played in Austin, Texas?
We played in Austin quite a few times. Yeah. The biggest thing that we did is when Lance Armstrong won the Tour de France for the 7th time, and he was going with Sheryl Crow, and everybody showed up, and we played on the Capitol steps on Congress, and it was probably 100,000 people easily.
Wow.
And you could see delay towers and, PA systems and, you know, screens and everything just going down infinity. Wow. It was like, it was crazy.
Wow. 100,000 is a good chunk of people in one spot, man.
So that was awesome. And Cheryl and Lance came up and sang Rock and Me with us. And we went to a party that they had afterwards. It was kind of fun. Mm. So that was a pretty big crowd. And then another time we played St. Louis on 4th of July with a military flyover of all the stuff.
Wow.
With fireworks and the whole bit. And that had to be close to 100,000 people.
Wow.
That was on the river.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know.
Do you write on the road, Kenny? Do you tend to write when you're off the road or it doesn't
matter? No, I write on the road because then I'm just not distracted, see? I can get in the back of that coach in the middle of the night, especially if the roads are bad and I can't sleep because I'm bouncing all this stuff. I'll get the laptop out at 3 in the morning and I'll just go because there's nothing to, I can't get anything on TV.
Yep.
The cell service is out.
Yep.
You know, I'm just all by myself. It's almost like being up in my cabin up in Montana.
Yeah.
You know, because you're out and, you know, you're disconnected, which is good.
Yeah.
And then I can get creative, you know.
Yeah.
So I write a lot in the bus. I write in the room on days off.
Mm-hmm.
I do get to write a little bit at home, but not as much as I'd like to because there's just so much stuff going on.
Yeah, yeah. Life. And then the cabin in Montana, do you write at the cabin?
Yes, I do. If I go, if I'm fortunate enough to be there by myself, because a lot of my friends know about it. And, of course, I always welcome them, and I don't want to be alone, you know. And my next-door neighbor, he's always coming over. I mean, I always have to, you know, kick him out just so I get some privacy. But if I'm by there by myself, which I might be at the end of this month because I'm just going to drive up and drive back, take up some stuff, I might, you know, do some writing.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, I can hook up an internet if I wanted to in there, but I haven't. It's just a bare wire hanging on the wall like this. So I haven't hooked it up yet.
Now
no telephone, no internet.
Now, the flip side, Kenny. Do you like, what kind of stuff do you like to read? History?
History. I like history. I like, you know, fantasy sci-fi novels that are, you know, like not too out there.
Mm-hmm.
I like them to tie in factual things with it. That's why I like Dan Brown.
Mm-hmm.
As for Stephen King, once in a while writes a really good piece that's not too, you know, out there.
Yeah.
And like It is like, okay, you know, clown in the sewer. Okay. Yeah. But, you know. You know, Stand By Me, that's a story, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
he wrote The Long Green Mile too, didn't he?
Yeah, he wrote a Green ton Mile. Of stuff, you know, wrote really good stuff too.
Yeah.
But you know, not all of his stuff freaks me out. But I mean, you know,
it's
the way it is. But I like to read, like, right now, believe it or not, I'm reading Godfather. Hmm. Never read it. Read it, excuse me.
The original.
Yeah, the
Mario Puzo.
Yeah, because the reason why I'm reading it is because I'm seeing how it was edited, because I'm doing editing on my own book right now, and I want to see how Coppola got in there and changed and flipped everything around and moved things around and stuff that he left alone. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, you get to kind of get a sense of how great stuff is remolded for the screen, but also just for popular storyline, you know. Because Mario was a little, you know, he was a little scattered. Yeah. I could see a lot of him and me, you know, because I'm reading him and going, oh, Mario, you're just like me. You're writing too much stuff. You know, you gotta take some of that stuff out, you know, even though it's interesting, you know.
Yeah.
So editing is an interesting part of the whole book writing thing, because if you don't have the editing together, you're probably not going to have a very successful book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Does Diane read your stuff before you?
No. She doesn't read a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
She reads short stuff.
Yeah.
She reads articles. She reads, you know, clips. She has books. She buys books. I can't honestly say that I think she's finished a lot of books, but she started a lot of books.
Do your stories come out as you're writing? Do you tend to recite them and go through them and talk about them a little bit, or is most of it silent to paper?
Silent.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I don't bounce it off her. I do have a couple people that are kind of into the publishing part of the world a little bit in terms of they're fans of other writers.
Yeah.
And I can send them, you know, like a couple chapters. Because, you know, it's a big thing to get somebody to read a whole book just to give you an opinion. I just had to do that with my editor. It cost me money. You know, it cost me money to ever just read the thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because she's, you know, she's got a lot of, on her plate. You know, she's got a kid.
It's her profession.
Yeah. So, you know, you got to pay her. Mm-hmm. So, and she came up with some really great ideas. Of course, some of it was depressing. Mm. You know, and I'm just like, oh, God, okay. Yeah, I got to do that. All right. And she's telling me the way my book sits right now is not ready for an agent or a publisher.
Yeah.
So I've got to make it that, you know.
Yeah.
So, but she did that with me on the first book, too. But, of course, we self-published that. So I have a good first book because of her. But unfortunately, we can't let none of that fruit we can use to, you know, go into a deal because I self-published, you know.
Yeah.
So it's fine. And the reason why I did that was because I wanted to see if I had the gene. I didn't know if I had the gene. You got to try it. It's like you have to do your demo before you do your master, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that book was kind of like a demo for me, but it ended up becoming a master by way of the way that we edited it and presented it.
It's interesting, Kenny. We were talking earlier that you were hanging out at some of the local venues and just checking out Cody Blackbird Band. And, you know, you're with one of the most recognizable bands in the world, the nation, of course, Steve Miller Band. I was talking to my uncle, he's 71. I said, I'm going to interview a guy from the Steve Miller Band. Oh, Steve Miller Band, you know. But Kenny Lee Lewis, now I recognize you because I've been around 5 or 6 years. I know the Steve Miller Band. We've seen each other and hung out. But a lot of people don't recognize you.
No.
They may wonder. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. And you know what? A lot of people don't recognize Steve. Steve could walk into a mall right here in town, and they would know who he was.
Mm.
And from what you just said, there's people that are our age. They never heard of the Steve Miller Band. They don't know who he is.
Interesting.
But when you sing the songs.
The songs.
And you start going, I like an eagle, and I'm a jigger, I'm a winner. Then they go, oh, I love that song. But they don't know his name.
That's interesting.
Because it's just a real common guy's name.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't know who the Steve Miller Band is.
Interesting.
But they know the catalog. And that was a really great lesson for me because it really showed how the art can precede the man.
Mm.
And that is really something when you think about how you can be invisible and you can let your product be the thing that actually does the talking for you rather than being a character with scandals and, you know, and you being on, you know, cover of, you know, tabloids and, you know, and a movie star, you know what I mean? I mean, it's all the stuff, you know, divorces, blah, blah, blah.
Don't need it.
Yeah. Steve, he could walk down the street and nobody even knows who he is unless you're a really, really big fan.
Yeah.
So I kind of like I kind of like that.
Yeah.
I think that I want to be like that too.
And you've had, Steve's had the opportunity. He talks about Paul McCartney and hanging out and being on his record, writing songs. And so he's got the best of both worlds. He gets to hang out. You get to rush, you know. Yeah. Yeah, not all the fame trappings. That's cool.
He's got access to, you know, the throne room.
Yeah.
But he can also just walk the streets and be free.
That's cool.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And that's cool.
And, you know, people, I mean, it's only after the show that he gets mauled, you know, for, you know, and of course there's ticket, you know, there's autograph hounds always.
Yeah.
And they know who he is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's not that many people. I mean, maybe a dozen every gig or something, you know. But, but yeah, I mean, we just did some gigs with Fogarty in England and Ireland. He's kind of like that.
Yeah.
You know, if he puts on sunglasses and a hat and he goes into...
know who he is.
Nobody knows. Yeah. Fogarty. He never had any scandals. Never was an actor. You know, just kind of a common guy from where is he from? I think he's from like Galt.
Or, Galt, California.
Like Galt.
Right near Lodi.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know his brother, and it's like, they're just, you know, normal people.
Yeah.
He just was a big Howlin' Wolf fan when he was a kid, and he kind of like became the white Howlin' Wolf.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Come on over to...
And did a very good job.
First record album you ever bought, Kenny Lee Lewis. Do you remember?
Yes. It was Are You Experience?
Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
How about you, Craig?
Actually, you know what? It was Axis Bold as Love, because Are You Experience had already come and gone, and I couldn't get it for whatever reason. But I went back and got it later. But yeah. No, the very first record was Axis Bold as Love.
Jimi Hendrix. Craig?
I can't really remember the first I bought. I just remember that my parents had the Mamas and the Papas.
Yeah.
Jefferson Airplane, Surrealistic Pillow.
Yeah.
That was a big one. Sergeant Pepper's, of course, was a big one. Those.
They stuck out.
I cherish those.
I have three. My dad bought me the Beach Boys Christmas album.
I'm sorry.
The Man with All the Toys. I actually loved it.
My apologies.
It was fun. My grandparents.
My
grandparents stepped up the game and walked in one afternoon and bought me Beatles 65, one of my favorite records. Loved it. And then. My first purchase was Green River by Creedence Clearwater.
There you go.
Love that record.
There you go.
Yeah.
Nazareth Hair of the Dog was big for me, too.
Wow.
Ain't no messing with
it. Now you're messing with it. Yeah.
Wow.
But I was a rock kid. I mean, you know, I grew up in the metal time era too. So I mean,
we've gone full circle. Here we are in a digital podcast talking about vinyl. So we've gone full circle tonight on The Slow Good Life with our guest, Kenny Lee Lewis, and of course, Kenny, great to have you, man.
Yeah.
Now,
wonderful.
I have turntables.
Yeah.
And if you ever want to, we have 10,000 vinyl records in storage over by the airport.
Oh.
If you ever want to, like, get some turntables hooked up and we could do a thing where we could just kind of blindfold reach into the box, kind of like,
we'd absolutely love to do that.
Just pull out stuff and then just kind of put it on for a second and go like, bleep, bleep.
Yeah.
Because I need to find out what the heck I got. Because we got all this stuff from my mother-in-law. We don't even know what we have. We've never said, it's all in these boxes. They're all sealed. They're all old. It's like, a lot of it's gospel, but there's also a lot of R&B from Motown and stuff. Of it's non-released Motown demos that they would test market on the radio.
Crazy.
And then my mother-in-law go, I didn't do too good. And they go back and they recut it. She's got the first tape.
I was going to ask you, where's those records at? That's cool, man.
I have them.
That is so cool.
I don't have them all, but I have a lot of them. You know, I got about 10,000.
Kenny, this is on Facebook. This is not a joke. Craig doesn't know this, but I started the San Luis Obispo Vinyl Record Reclamation Society. I did. It's on there. And basically it says, if you have a vinyl record collection and you're on the verge of just getting rid of it, we will come look at that collection and we will preserve the best of that collection. And if you ever want to come over and hear them, they will be available. The vinyl record.
Well, can you handle 10,000?
We'll
That's about as many as we have.
We'll sift through them, Craig, and pick out the jewels that need to be rescued.
I'm serious.
No, that's
man. It's taking up room. I'm having to pay for these every month, and the price of them are like gone off the scale now because of the amount of money we.
My thinking cap is on. My thinking
so there's
cap
never going
to
be
on.
Any profit made from them.
No.
So we might as well just take them and make them available to the world.
Yes.
Just to let people enjoy them.
I love that idea. Yeah, I love that idea. I'm looking forward to it, man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Putting on the record
it's
and going.
Martha Jean, the Queen Steinberg's record collection.
I love it.
And then mine and Diane's personal ones were kind of thrown in there, but ours is minuscule compared to what she had as a DJ. There were thousands that got damaged in her basement from flooding and stuff. They'd throw them out.
It's crazy.
She had so many records.
These are probably, there's probably several that are irreplaceable that may be one of a kind.
Yeah. Supposedly we have a red colored vinyl record of her interviewing. Malcolm X.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you can even get it anymore. It was kind of a local thing they did.
Wow.
So we're going to look for that one. But it's colored red because, of course, he had red hair.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
amazing.
That's
crazy.
Yeah, all the gems in there.
Well, Craig Marshall, thank you so much, man, for
having a great time tonight.
Kenny Lee Lewis in the house.
Good questions. Good questions.
Thank you. Thank you for the input. Thank you for your vibe and spirit and your music, Kenny. We appreciate you, man.
My pleasure.
So you've been listening to another episode of The Slow Good Life. I'm your host, James Davis. Co-host Craig Marshall, Kenny Lee Lewis. Keep it going. Check us out on slowtalkpodcasting.com for The Slow Good Life. We'll see you next time. This episode of The Slow Good Life is brought to you by Slow Talk Podcasting, a turnkey recording studio featuring podcast development, production, distribution, and marketing. Check out Slow Talk Podcasting online at slowtalkpodcasting.com or call them at 805-234-5056.